Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I want to say some opening brief remarks about the official views of the Catholic Church, in order to give you a sense of how Christianity might be related to the natural law, and more generally, how you might think about the relationship between faith and reason. It'd be hard to overestimate, I think, the importance of the natural law to the Catholic Church and to Christian intellectual life. The Church's modes of argumentation, moral teachings, many of her greatest thinkers, reams of official documents, they're all steeped in the natural law. For example, this is in 2019, the Supreme Court of the Philippines dismissed a petition asking the court to declare Articles 1 and 2 of the Family Code unconstitutional. Now, these were provisions that limited marriage to a union between one man and one woman. This was by no means the first skirmish in the debate on same-sex marriage in the Philippines. In 2015, so just 10 years ago, when Ireland voted overwhelmingly to approve same-sex marriage, a Philippines archbishop warned his countrymen not to jump on the bandwagon. Same-sex marriage, he said, is against the natural law. In other words, we might say same-sex marriage, he thinks, is contrary to natural human morality, as well as Catholic moral teaching. What might it mean to say something like that is part of what I want to think about this evening. If you look at the 1992 Catechism of the Catholic Church, it's a great place to begin reflecting on Catholic understanding of the natural law. It has a section called the moral law, which begins with a section on the natural moral law. Here's what it says. Man participates in the wisdom and goodness of the Creator who gives him mastery over his acts and the ability to govern himself with a view to the true and the good. The natural law expresses the original moral sense, which enables man to discern by reason, not by revelation, the good and the evil, the truth and the lie. The Catechism then quotes Pope Leo XIII's 1888 encyclical on the nature of human liberty. This is the quotation. The natural law is written and engraved in the soul of each and every man, because it's human reason ordaining him to do good and forbidding him to sin. But this command of human reason would not have the force of law if it were not the voice and interpreter of a higher reason to which our spirit and our freedom must be submitted. So, natural law, according to this way of thinking, it's some kind of original moral sense. It allows us to discern the first and essential precepts which govern the moral life. This natural sense is given to each of us at our coming into being and can never be fully eradicated from our hearts. Its precepts are universal, and its authority extends to all. Particular applications, then, of the natural law vary greatly, but nevertheless, in the diversity of cultures, the natural law remains as a rule that binds men among themselves and imposes on them, beyond inevitable differences, common principles. To underscore this last point, the Catechism includes a quotation from Cicero, the pre-Christian Roman statesman and philosopher, who wrote in his Republic that there is a true law, right reason. It is in conformity with nature, is diffused among all men, and is immutable and eternal. Failure to apply even one of its provisions is forbidden. No one can abrogate it entirely. And yet, despite this universal and authoritative moral sense, the precepts of the natural law are not perceived by everyone clearly and immediately. The principal references in the Catechism are to church documents and the writings of people like Cicero, as well as Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas. The Catechism thereby claims that the connection, the church's connection, Christianity's connection to the long and venerable natural law tradition is a tradition that took root in Greece and Rome and was in turn appropriated and extended by Christian theologians. St. Thomas Aquinas, in particular, devoted a substantial section of his Summa Theologiae to the nature and types of law. And indeed, some of you may know this, St. Thomas is now considered the paradigmatic natural law theorist. What that means, at least in part, is that if you don't think Thomas Aquinas has the right way of thinking about natural law, then you have to have an explanation for it. He's a place you need to begin when thinking about natural law. Now, let me begin with his definition of law, which might be familiar to some of you. It stands at the beginning of his discussion of law as a whole, and it goes as follows. Law is an ordinance of reason for the common good, promulgated by the one who is in charge of the community. Now, let me talk a little bit about this. There are four things that are mentioned in that definition. Here they are. A law, according to Aquinas, must include the following. It must be an ordinance of reason. Since a law is a standard of action, it's a source of all standards of human action, reason should be at the foundation. So a law must embody some rational order. Laws must make sense of our human circumstances such that they protect and promote our ends as human beings. The speed limit, for example, guides human behavior towards genuine human goods. Now, some of you might know that for a time, the daytime speed limit in Montana, do you all know what it was?
There was none.
Well, there was none. There was one, but it wasn't a number. The daytime speed limit in law was reasonable and prudent. The speed limit that's reasonable and prudent. So if you could demonstrate that you were driving a reasonable and prudent speed, you would not receive a ticket. Now, it's not that way anymore, and you can imagine there's a lot of people who made a lot of bad arguments. But at any rate, it's a good reminder what's sort of at the foundation of law. It's supposed to engage our reason, something reasonable, something connected to the rational structure of our lives. Second, law must be ordered towards the common good. Since our happiness is most properly a function of the happiness of the community as a whole, laws must be ordained to that common communal happiness. Someone might like to have his own personal speed limit exercisable in his own personal highway lane. I think of this as the HOV lane, the Hain-only lane. Such a legal arrangement would serve only a private good rather than the good of the whole community. More provocatively, actually, Aquinas argues that even if I had my own private driving lane, it wouldn't be for my own good. That would actually not promote my good. I'm from Rhode Island, so I think about driving a lot. I hope you'll forgive me. Third, so reasonable, common good. Third, a law must be made by one who has authority over the relevant community. I can't decide on my own what the speed limit should be, even if I know better than others what limit would be best, and let me tell you, I do. Only the community as a whole, or those who represent the community, can legitimately make that decision. And last, a law must be promulgated. That's why the speed limit signs have to be up. If you don't know what the speed limit is, you can't be accused of breaking it, since a law that is not communicated to the people is a law in name only. Now, these four features, it's reasonable, it's for the common good, it's made by one in authority, and it's promulgated. Those four characteristics are most easily understood in terms of ordinary things, like speed limits. But Aquinas says they're present in four different kinds of law. Eternal law, positive or human law, divine law, and my topic this evening, natural law. Positive law or human laws are things like speed limits, laws that a human community forms through a regular legislative process. Divine laws are those laws given to us by God through divine revelation, including, for example, the Ten Commandments and the new law of the Gospels. Laws guide us, and we need the special guidance of divine revelation to guide us to our supernatural end, an end that our own nature can't guide us to on its own. The eternal law is the ultimate source of all laws. And in a sense, for Aquinas and for others who are thinking like this, it represents the mind of the universe. In a more concrete sense, the mind of God. But it represents the rational order of all that exists. In particular, it represents divine providence. The whole community of the universe, says Aquinas, is governed by divine reason. Wherefore, the very idea of the government of things in God, the ruler of the universe, has the nature of a law. All other laws for Aquinas, insofar as they're laws, find their source in God's eternal law. Now, my topic, natural law, the last type of law, it's our participation in that universal rational order of all that exists. Here's Aquinas again. The rational creature is subject to divine providence in the most excellent way. It has a share of the eternal reason, whereby it has a natural inclination to its proper act and end. And this participation of the eternal law in the rational creature is called natural law. Now, to see what Aquinas might mean by this, consider an example. For the past few years, a rabbit has been living in my yard. And for a while, we thought it might be eating our vegetables. So my teenage son tried to catch it. One time he succeeded, though his sisters refused to let him kill it and eat it. I thought that was a bit unfortunate, actually, but nevertheless, that rabbit is governed by the eternal law, according to Aquinas, as is all creation. The manifestation of the universal rational order in the life of that rabbit consists in its natural inclinations and instincts. Animals in general act according to set patterns of behavior, and those patterns are the natural law for those rabbits. Aquinas says we, human beings, participate in the natural law in a further sense. Not only do we have a set of inclinations and patterns of behavior similar to other animals, but we can use our reason to identify how we participate in the law, what's good and bad for us, and in turn, we're free to choose to act in accordance with the laws that govern us or not. Think of the natural law, then, as the way that our human nature embodies the rational structure of the universe, thereby giving us guidance that's naturally available regarding what's good, what's bad, what will make us happy, and what will make us miserable. Now, Aquinas' discussion of the natural law, especially question 94, article 2, and can I ask, have any of you read question 94, article 2? A few of you, okay. Especially that article, which I'm about to just give a short summary of it. It's produced extensive discussion and controversy. I think it's fair to say that more has been written by Thomistic scholars about this passage over the last 50 years than about any other particular specific article in the Summa. I'm not going to unravel all these debates this evening, though I want to gesture towards a couple fault lines here in order to talk about the contemporary usefulness of natural law theory. Now, Aquinas argues in that article that all the precepts of the natural law are built on a single first principle. Good is to be done and evil avoided. All those things to which man has a natural inclination, we naturally apprehend, he says, by reason as being good. and consequently as objects of pursuit, and their contraries as evil, and objects of avoidance. Aquinas organizes our natural inclinations into three groups. First, there's the inclinations we share with all creatures, even inanimate ones, to preserve ourselves and to ward off threats. So, natural law includes those precepts commanding us to preserve and defend ourselves as living creatures. Second, there are the inclinations we share with animals. And in virtue of these inclinations, those things are said to belong to the natural law which nature has taught to all animals, such as sexual intercourse, education of offspring, and so on. Finally, we have those inclinations that concern our good according to reason. And thus we have a natural inclination to know the truth, especially about the first cause, or God, to live in society. And in this respect, whatever pertains to these inclinations also belongs to the natural law. For example, to shun ignorance, to avoid offending those among whom we live, and other such things. As rational animals, our nature includes a wide range of inclinations, organized around our achievement of our good, our happiness. The natural law is the rational structure of our human nature, a structure that we, in turn, have a desire to know and to act upon, even though we can also choose to reject it. Here's another example. Aquinas clearly argues that theft is contrary to the natural law, meaning that theft violates our deepest natural inclinations, and as such never promotes our true happiness. In turn, we have a natural inclination to know that theft is wrong and to act accordingly, even though it's possible sometimes to forget, as it were, that theft is wrong, and even if we know it's wrong. It's possible for us to choose it anyway, in spite of ourselves. Rabbits, we might say, should not eat meat. It's against their nature. And humans should not steal. It's against our nature. Now, Aquinas' presentation of all of this is an extraordinarily impressive achievement, and it will be read and reread long after all of us, dare I say, have left this earth. What particular relevance does it have for us today? In particular, for the kinds of debates occurring in the Philippines and elsewhere around all those difficult moral questions that we all face. If Aquinas is right, how do each of us learn the content of the natural law? And how is the natural law philosophically or otherwise identified and defended? The natural law is, well, it's supposed to be natural, written into our hearts and our bones in some fashion. Now, perhaps we come to know the natural law by observing ourselves and our inclinations and the lives of others like ourselves. Just as we come to know what's good for rabbits by watching them, so we come to know what's good for us by observing our inclinations, biological and otherwise, and then deriving important moral truths from those observations. This way of thinking begins, we might say, with a philosophy of human nature, which in turn depends on biology and the other natural sciences. Returning to the problem of human sexuality, we learn at least in part what the nature and purpose of human sexuality is by understanding the biological complementarity of men and women. I think the best defender of this approach, that we must begin with a philosophy of human nature, think seriously about biology, is a philosopher named Stephen Jensen. He's currently at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. And he's a student of the distinguished classical Thomist Ralph McInerney, who taught for many years at the University of Notre Dame. He argued recently in a very good book called Knowing the Natural Law, From Precepts and Inclinations to Deriving Oughts. He argued that we come to know the natural law only by means of first understanding human nature and our natural inclinations, and then concluding from this to the content of the natural law. we begin with a kind of observational knowledge of human nature, and then reason to the practical moral knowledge of the natural law. But there is another possibility, a possibility developed and championed by another group of philosophers, often referred to as the new natural lawyers. May I ask how many of you have heard that phrase, new natural lawyers? That's the professor corner. Yeah, but only a couple of you. Okay. The new natural lawyers. The most important living member of this group is John Finnis. He's a longtime faculty member of the University of Oxford, as well as the University of Notre Dame. He split his time over the years. And he argued in his now classic book, Natural Law and Natural Rights, that we come to know the natural law not so much by reflecting on human nature or the fruits of biology, but through practical reasoning itself. For Finnis, knowledge is a human good, and it's a human good because of the structure of our nature as a rational creature. But we don't come to know that it's good by means of a study of human nature. As Finnis says, the good of knowledge is self-evident. It's obvious. We come to know that knowledge, that knowing things, is good for us by means of the practical experience of coming to know, and not by reasoning to the conclusion that knowledge is good from some prior understanding of human nature. Think about this, then, as a dispute or a question about how we come to know the natural law. It has important implications for how you might build an argument in support of someone like the bishop in the Philippines. Both the old and the new natural law advocates believe that the natural law is an expression of our human nature's rational participation in the eternal law. But they would both say, for example, that there's a metaphysical dependence or a deep structural dependence of the natural law on our human nature. But epistemologically, how we come to know it, these two approaches are opposed. The older approach begins with our nature. It's as if you observe human beings and then can see what they need and what they should do. The new approach begins with the internal perspective. Think about your own experience of acting and choosing this or that and how you respond to it. And through reflecting on that experience, you can reveal to yourself the content of the natural law. Now, which side you come down on helps determine how you defend particular moral teachings, what kinds of evidence you will consider threatening to your own conclusions. Now, for those of you interested, by the way, I'm not going to say too much more about this, but there's a very nice two-part series on the difference between these two approaches that came out in 2019 at Public Discourse. How many of you have heard of Public Discourse? It's an online magazine. Okay, I warmly recommend it to all of you. It's a little politics heavy, but also philosophy. It's put out, it's got some connections to Princeton. Really great articles. Melissa Moschella, who's a philosopher who recently moved from the Catholic University of America to the University of Notre Dame, does a really nice job summarizing these two approaches, and she's thinking about sexual morality. So it's a really nice presentation of two ways of thinking about specific natural law teaching. Now, it's worth noting, by the way, that texts like the Catechism just doesn't take a stand on this question. It remains open how we think about the best way to come to know the particular conclusions of the natural law. But it does say that we possess an original moral sense, which enables us to discern by reason the good and the evil. How exactly this happens is still left somewhat open. But however we settle this uncertainty, it's a question or an argument among friends. Both approaches accept the importance of human nature as a foundation for natural law, and the problem is best how to explain and defend our awareness of that law. But there is a deeper objection to the natural law tradition. It's what we might call a metaphysical objection, an objection to how we think about the world around us. Many people find the entire idea of natural law absurd, because they find the idea of human nature absurd. The reasons for this are not hard to find. Darwin's On the Origin of Species, published in 1859, established the discipline of evolutionary biology. It's a discipline that for some time now has seen little usefulness in the traditional concept of human nature. Human nature, as understood by someone like Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas, is our unique human essence with its necessary and sufficient properties. The classical definition of human nature is rational animal. Human nature, so conceived, provides the philosophical foundation for human morality. It establishes the conditions for human flourishing. Natural law then expresses the requirements of that flourishing. This is sometimes called biological essentialism. It's been almost universally rejected in the philosophy of biology and theoretical biology over the last 50 years or so. Evolutionary theory conceives of human beings as the unpredictable and unstable products of a long genealogical process that does not permit neat divisions between species. There appears to be no set of necessary and sufficient properties possessed by all and only human beings. Instead, the biological world is a kind of continuum of constantly changing individuals and population clusters. Here's a passage, it's a little bit long, but I think worth reading. Consider this passage from a contemporary philosopher of biology. Because of the variability of life, there are no necessary and sufficient conditions for being a member or part of a biological species. Each individual is different. Some individuals may be missing one characteristic typical of the kind, for example, the capacity to walk upright. Others a different characteristic, such as language, despite them all belonging to the same kind. The kind's cohesion is created by genealogy and other evolutionary mechanisms rather than by similarity. Variability entails that a defensible biological account of characteristics of a kind is statistical, not essential, statistical through and through, right down to the genetic level. This latter point holds since there's not even a single gene that is strictly shared by all and only the members of a particular species. Therefore, Darwinian thinking with respect to species is populational, oriented towards statistical features of a population, rather than typological, oriented towards types, individuals strictly instantiating an essence. That's from Maria Kronfelder. She rejects the traditional essentialist understanding of human nature and instead believes that the idea of human nature is useful in different ways and in different contexts, but it has no deep foundation in the nature of the world. Human nature in this sense would be completely useless for any conception of natural law, since a merely descriptive concept of human nature doesn't say anything at all about what will make us happy, how we should act, what human flourishing and human goodness might look like, and why it might be the same for you as it is for me. Statistically speaking, after all, human beings are not very good and not very happy. Now, this is a difficult problem. If human beings are rational animals, then what do we do with all those apparently human animals who are not particularly rational? This includes the unborn, of course, as well as the severely disabled, and often enough, a significant number of the elderly. If the traditional concept of human nature as an essence that's possessed by all and only human beings remains viable, we need a way to explain its presence in our fellows who never manifest typically human behavior. Now, despite such criticisms, there remain robust defenses of the traditional approach to human nature that can accept Darwinian evolutionary theory and still provide a foundation for a traditional understanding of the natural law. We're actually currently experiencing a revival in essentialist accounts of human nature within the philosophy of biology. And here I'll just mention thinkers like Michael Devitt and Travis Dumsday, both quite remarkable. Devitt just put out a book exactly on this theme. And he's not particularly religious as he's thinking about these problems. They and others have helped make essentialism intellectually respectable again. And it must be taken seriously. Now, the most promising defenses of classical essentialism begin by reminding us that living organisms are different from non-living ones. And whereas evolutionary biology does present us with challenges to the traditional understanding of biological species and human nature, it can't completely do away with the central features of living things that provide a basis for speaking of morally significant natural kinds. Now, here at the end, I just want to spend a few minutes on the work of Michael Thompson. He's a philosopher at the University of Pittsburgh. He's a very interesting thinker. He's a student of Philippa Foote, who was an Oxford philosopher, who's a close friend of the philosophers Elizabeth Anscombe and Peter Geech. They were a Catholic married couple at the center of mid-20th century Oxford Catholic intellectual life, quite remarkable people. Michael Thompson, like Philippa Foote, is a defender of an Aristotelian approach to ethics, and so a defender of the metaphysical foundations of any natural law tradition, though again, in his case, not particularly religious. Thompson shows that the language we use when talking about biological organisms has some remarkable features. For example, attempts to explain what living things are will include a variety of characteristics. Living organisms, we might say, are those that grow, metabolize, respond to stimuli, and reproduce. But just to pick on one of these characteristics, what do we mean by claiming that living things, as opposed to non-living things, grow? To increase in size? Well, the dust in the corner of my living room does that. No, we might say, I mean that living things grow by taking in new material and transforming it into itself so as to increase its size. Well, lakes and rivers do that every time it rains. Here we seem to have a problem distinguishing between living and non-living processes of growth. We could fix it by saying that living things grow by the process of metabolization. But now we have another problem. We've defined one living process in terms of another. And when it comes to defining what we mean by metabolize, it will turn out that we're in a pickle little different from the one we found ourselves in with respect to growth. In other words, attempts to define life end up either unable to distinguish living things from non-living ones, or they end up going round in a circle. Living things are the ones that grow in the ways characteristic of living things. Now, we possess many concepts like this: organism, life, organ, vital operation, species, and so on. These can be defined only in terms of one another. The language of life is separate from the language of non-living things. And we can't talk about living things by means of the concepts of non-living things. There's something irreducible about our understanding of life. Now consider the following sentence: a black Angus cattle eat grass. This sentence is not quantifiable in any ordinary way. Now, when I say black Angus cattle eat grass, I don't mean to say that all black Angus cattle eat grass. Of the more than, I don't know, a million, some hundreds of thousands registered black Angus in the United States right now, many of them are too young to eat grass or fed other kinds of food, such as corn. And I certainly don't mean that this or that particular black Angus cow eats grass. It could be the case that no black Angus cow is actually eating grass. Philosophers, you know, they only have to imagine it in order to make it so. Maybe there's some sad plot afoot, or a hoof, and all the black Angus cattle in the world have been rounded up and will be fed anything other than grass from here on out. Nevertheless, black Angus cattle eat grass is a true sentence. Thompson calls sentences like that natural historical judgments. Or in another place, Aristotelian categoricals. They're categorical in the sense that they don't allow for exceptions. Though, as I pointed out, that doesn't mean that this or that particular cow can't be an exception. The universality implied is a different kind of universality. It means something like, all properly constituted and healthy black Angus cows eat grass. And there are many, many similar judgments like this one. Horses have four legs. Acorns grow into oak trees. Adult humans have 32 teeth, and so on. These statements are not straightforward claims about individuals. They say something about the life form in question. And as the phrase that I used before, properly constituted and healthy, suggests, these statements have implications for judgments we might like to make. These judgments, normative judgments, norm-providing, and so law-like, they have implications like this. Well, a black Angus cow should eat grass. Or horses ought to have four legs. These are statements about health or illness or flourishing. They're generally speaking normative judgments because they establish norms against which we judge individuals who measure up more or less to the standard in question. How many black Angus cattle are healthy? Well, we can determine that by looking at those categorical statements and applying them to the black Angus cattle that are alive. If this way of thinking is right, then we have a good way to ground the natural law tradition. Claims about human morality, like claims about human health, are normative claims that are founded on our form of life. Humans have two eyes. That provides a foundation for saying, I ought to have two eyes, and missing an eye is a defect in human beings. Likewise, humans are rational. Provides a foundation for saying, I ought to know the truth, and ignorance is a defect in human beings. When Aquinas argues that there's three general categories of natural laws, tendency to self-preservation, to my nature as an animal, and to the habits and behaviors of rational beings, he's pointing to the human form as the metaphysical ground for the natural law. Thompson gives us a way of recognizing this foundation in the way we speak, in our language. If we were to accept the objection suggested by evolutionary biology that there's no species determinate enough to ground natural law ethics, then Thompson's Aristotelian categoricals would be nothing more than human inventions imposed on the world around us, and we could make no sense not only of natural law morality, but of health and disease, growth and decay, life and death, all those concepts that depend on the larger evaluative grasp of life or life form or species. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to conclude that the natural law tradition remains coherent and promising with respect to human morality, even after the developments of evolutionary biology since Darwin. And the Catholic Church should remain confident in her appropriation of that tradition as a manifestation of God's plan for all human beings. This is a broader sign of the Church's unflagging commitment to the compatibility between faith and reason. The law God reveals will never contradict the law of our nature, though revelation can and must shore up our natural awareness of the moral law. This doesn't mean that natural law arguments are easy to make, or easy to understand, or non-controversial once they're expounded. I don't know if natural law reasoning will win the day in the immediate future in the Philippines. Though such reasoning can and should be an important part of whatever strategy the defenders of traditional marriage use to support their position. Ultimately, the Catholic position or the Christian position, like the position of St. Thomas, is a position of hopefulness. The natural world, deep down at its foundations, possesses a rational structure that reflects the mind of a creator and harmonizes with revelation. It's possible for us to understand that structure, to come to see it, to love it, by means of our natural powers. For this reason, we should never give up in the face of skepticism about natural human morality. Among the many things for which we must be grateful to St. Thomas Aquinas, not least is his constant reminder to us that God is good, and so what he makes is good, and we, his creatures, by reflecting on his creation, can always hope to be led ultimately back to the Creator and to his plan for us. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.